history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this beautiful country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are those seemingly ordinary Americans who really have done extraordinary things for our country. And there are also those who will never ever take their freedom for granted because they know what it's like to live without it. That's going to be our focus today as we once again seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we will never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And of course, along that journey, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you're a regular listener to this show, there's no doubt that dates like December 7th, June 6th, May 8th, August 14th, those all hold significance for you. But there's another very important observance every year whose date changes just a little bit because it's always the third Friday in September. In the case of this year, that's September 15th. It's National POW/MIA Recognition Day. And all across our great nation this weekend, people are gathering to honor those who have endured the hardships of being a prisoner of war, and also to remember those who remain missing in action. In preparing for this program, I took a little inventory, and of the nearly 500 episodes of Hometown Heroes that are archived for you online, I counted 44 ex-prisoners of war interviewed in 14 different states. They represent the majority of states in our union if you go back to where they grew up. And I've been privileged to encounter quite a few more ex-POWs who have never shared their stories here. I'm continually amazed by their perspective, taking nothing for granted and persevering through everything that comes their way, even today. During World War II, more than 130,000 Americans were captured by enemy forces. That's less than 1% of the more than 16 million American men and women in uniform. But POW/MIA Recognition Day is also to remember the more than 82,000 Americans who remain missing in action. That includes 73,000 from World War II alone, and over 40,000 of them presumed lost at sea, a number that includes nearly 900 aboard the recently discovered cruiser USS Indianapolis. This day of remembrance exists to say to all of them, you are not forgotten. And wherever you're listening today, there are events in your area this weekend to honor POWs past and present, as well as those who are still missing. I hope you have a chance to go, because I know it'll leave an impression on you. And if you don't make it this weekend, I do know of at least one happening next weekend, because I'll be speaking at it in Bakersfield, California. I'll give you the details a little later, and I do have the info at hometownheroesradio.com, but two of the ex-prisoners of war who plan to be there are a combined 200 years old. Think about that. One is 98, the other 102. They've both shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes, and you're going to hear some excerpts from their stories in a bit. We'll hear from three different ex-POWs today, and one thing they all had in common, all three of them were married before they headed overseas. Just imagine what their wives and other family members went through as they learned they were missing, then captured, and wondered if they'd ever get to see him again. We're going to begin with Ray Maloney, originally from New York City. In November of 1944, just a week shy of his 22nd birthday, he would be shot down in the P-47 Thunderbolt he was piloting for the 86th Fighter Bomber Group in Italy.
The P-47 was so big and heavy that when you put that nose down and dive, it winds up like, you know, there's nothing could stay with it. And the word was always, if you get a 109 on your tail, head for the deck, because he's not going to be able to stay with you, you know. Mm-hmm. It winds up 400, 500, 600 miles an hour. And during the war, there were a number of occasions where fellows actually entered transonic. They almost went supersonic.
Yeah.
Paint would peel off the wings and things like this, you know, with a jug. And so being hit in a dive was really not a big worry, but it was when you were attacking people that could shoot back at you that, you know. And a lot of times there would be banks of, in fact, when I was shot down, it was a classic. It was a car with four banks of 20 millimeters, and each gun has four barrels. So you have 16 20 millimeters firing at you. And so long as you're, you know, going by, they have to lead you so much that rarely can they get you. But as soon as you turn around and start committing, you know, now you become a stable target. You're coming right at them. You know? And you can see these baseballs coming at you, you know, as you go down. But
you mean you had your eyes open?
yeah, you better. Because there's other guys doing it too, you know. You know, we don't want to collide with each other.
So you're on a dive. Yeah. And this anti-aircraft artillery is coming,
it's coming up at
you.
Yeah.
And where did it hit your plane?
I don't know. It was in the fuel system somewhere because I felt the bang, you know. And it took a few seconds as I peeled off and I saw some more of the baseballs, you know, coming back at you. Within a few seconds, I noticed my fuel pressure started to fluctuate. And then finally it started to zero and I panicked. I didn't. And the P-47 has, for starting your engine, there's a little primer. Mm-hmm. You turn it and the little primer right on the instrument panel. And so the only thing I could think of, I uncorked it and started putting it, and I could bring the fuel pressure up. I could, you know, a little bit, so it kept the engine running while I primed and I peeled off this thing and started making a turn south. And I told him, I said, I'm hit. And my wingman stayed with me, and I thought, well, maybe, and I got it up to, I think, about 7,000 or 8,000 feet, still pumping like mail at this thing.
Was your arm getting tired of pumping that little
prime? Yeah, I was frightened to death, you know. And my wingman said, you're smoking, it looks like you're on fire. He couldn't see fire, but he could see smoke coming out of me. So I said, yeah, I think I am on fire, because it was seemed to be getting warm in the cockpit. But I started to head south, and you got to cross the Apennine Mountains in Italy. I can't remember what the altitudes were, probably maybe 8,000 on down, you know.
Sure.
And again, without power, the P-47 is so heavy, it's only going one way when you don't have power, and that's down. And so I couldn't hold altitude. I kept falling down. And finally, I got to a point where I had a kind of a hill, a mountain in front of me, and I knew I couldn't clear that, so I turned this way and headed down, and now I'm down in a valley. And it's amazing. I've thought through many times since then about how I ever managed to go through this thinking process that probably took a split second. Because as soon as I looked at this valley, I knew there was no place I could put this airplane. So I had to get out of it, mm-hmm. you know. And just like that, I just unhooked everything, climbed out the left side, and kicked out. And I saw the airplane still smoking, and I saw it one quick thing, and I looked back, and bam, it was that quick. And since then, I've tried to, in my mind, because people have a lot said, how high were you? I don't know how high I was, but it was in this valley, and I was heading down into the valley. And I, in my mind's eye, when I've tried to recreate those few seconds, and I think it was about no more than 5 seconds, maybe 4 seconds before I hit the ground. And my chute, I never got that jerk, you know, that you're supposed to get. The good Lord, I think, was watching over me that day. And my wingman, I found out much later, years later, he reported that, he said, I don't think he made it. He said, I didn't see that chute really blossom. It streamed out. But and I hit right on my heels and my rear end. And it went, bah, you know, I could feel it. It was a terrible pain.
Hey, your chute never opened. But yet you survived,
partially.
Or never fully opened it, yet you survived. Maybe that is miraculous.
Yeah.
B, had you waited one more second?
Yeah, I wouldn't have had any room to bail out. I would have had to try to crash into the side of the... There was no place down there that was flat.
1 second, you know? And you would have been gone. Well, never would have seen your wife again. Three kids, 9 grandkids, 5 great-grandkids. Wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I didn't think about those at the moment, but... But,
yikes.
Yeah, I think, and I've since, not because of that episode, but now that I'm old and closer to my maker, I've gotten religion and I now go to church every Sunday trying to make amends.
So you hit the ground and you mentioned your heels and your rear end. How long was it till you started feeling some pretty severe pain?
Oh, immediately. Yeah. Right away. I couldn't stand up. It was that painful. I was on my hands and knees. And the Germans, they sent a patrol up, 6 or 7 men. And I could tell that they were looking for me. You know, they were pointing and talking. There's part of it I don't want to talk about, but within about 10 minutes or so, I was out of ammunition. And one guy said, "Stand up," in English. And I tried to stand up, and I closed my eyes. I thought, I'm going to get killed right now. And the only German words I could think of was kaput, you know. And I said, "Kaput, kaput." And so they came over, and they recognized that I was on my hands and knees. I could barely move. And so it still was very painful, but they took 2 rifles, and I sat on the 2 rifles and put my arms around these 2 Germans, and they carried me maybe 400 or 500 yards to some little dugout where they had, were spending the night. They had a little straw in a little tiny roof thing there, and I spent the night there, and then the next day took me down to some little medical facility that Germans had, and I spent, I think, 2 days there, and they put a big piece of canvas from groin to up under my arms to try to support my back, and I started my sojourn up to Germany.
What gave you hope in that situation? Because I'm sure you had to have some hope to keep going.
Yeah, well, you know, it sounds kind of fluky, but you have to kind of come to grips with yourself, you know, what you're faced with now. And I kind of knew where we were in the war, and, you know, I knew we were winning. And I told myself, well, I'll give it 6 months, you know. And at the end of the 6 months, if nothing's happened, then I'm going to have to do something. You know, I thought, well, I'll wait 6 months, and if I'm still here, I'm going to have to then actively pursue something to get out of here, you know, or escape or something. And it happened almost exactly 6 months to where, you know, the war ended. And, you know, as I mentioned when we started talking, Paul, being a prisoner of war is a degrading, humiliating kind of experience, and it's not something that I'm proud of. It didn't take any skill or, you know, specialty to get captured. And because I didn't finish my tour, and a lot of my friends did, and a lot of my friends were killed, I always felt guilty about being. And I could tell from talking to other people in the camp, they have the same feeling, that it's a terrible guilt feeling that you're not helping at this point, you know. Even though your instructions are, when you are captured, you are still a military, you're still U.S. Army, and your responsibility is to do what you can to, you know, confuse, confound, and, you know, aggravate the enemy as much as you can. I was, you know, a junior. Here I am, a second lieutenant. Yeah. I'd just been shot down, and I was in a room with fellows that had been down since Tobruk, you know, 4 years before that, you know. So they had all the experience in the world, and I was a know-nothing, you know, an American. But you knew that they had learned over the months and years how to survive mentally and emotionally, you know, in a prison camp. Now, the food, the movies never describe, you know, never get into this, but there is an absolute eternal hunger, a yearning for food. You don't get enough food, and you're hungry. It's gnawing at you. The only thing that would kept us alive was Red Cross parcels used to come through. Not all the time, but when they came through, the package was about 11 pounds of food, and it had like a can of corned beef and some biscuits and a chocolate bar, a couple of packs of cigarettes, powdered milk in a can, you know, things of this sort. And it was designed to keep one man alive for 1 week. But the whole time I was a POW, the most they ever got was half a carton a week. So two men to a carton per week. So we were starving, you know, slowly starving. I only know my own experience. Well, everybody was turning into a skeleton. But I was always a tall, skinny kid. And when I was shot down, I weighed 165. And when I was liberated and the Americans weighed me, I weighed 125. So I'd gone through 40 pounds in just 6 months.
Makes you wonder how much longer you could have survived.
Yeah, it's this gnawing, and it's 24 hours a day. When you sleep, you dream about food.
Did you ever fear that you would die there in the POW camp?
Not right in the camp, but as the Russians were advancing, and of course the Americans and the British were advancing, the rumors started to come that we were going to be evacuated and taken down into an Austrian redoubt where the Germans were going to hide out to the end. The scuttlebutt was we were going to be the bargaining chip. They were going to hold us to the last minute and then bargain us out in terms of more favorable surrenders.
Right.
You know, and of course, we had been evacuated once from Sargon when the Russians
tell me about that. That must have been quite an interesting experience.
It was a snowstorm, you know. We had been following, you know, the Russians, and we knew they were getting closer and closer. We went through, I think, 4 nights and 5 days marching. And that was the worst winter that they had had in 50 years in Germany. The average temperature, they were saying, for that march was 17 below zero. So it was freezing cold, you know. You know, a lot of people have referred to it as the German death march.
And, yeah.
And I never want to put it that bad, certainly. But there were a number of people we had heard that had been shot trying to run, you know, to escape.
Well, and there were some who had been marching before the Russians got to you because the Russians had got to them sooner.
Oh, yeah. There were parades of these people headed west, you know, from all of the camps that were out in the East End. That's when we ended up down at Moosburg, you know, which was about 30 miles northeast of Munich. The camp was designed for 14,000, and I think they ended up with over 50,000 people. The day we were liberated in the morning, there was a big battle. We were right outside of Moosburg. We could see the town, the roofs, and there was a church steeple and a flagpole. You could see the German flag all the time. And there was just bang, bang, bang. It went on all morning. And so we knew that they were within, you know, a mile or so of us. And so we all waited and sweated. And we were in the toilet, which was a cement concrete building, and looking out the empty windows at this thing. And it had the German flag. And I guess around noontime, the shooting seemed to stop. And it was quiet for a while. And then the German flag came down. And we were all watching this. And an American flag... I can't even say it without. Yeah.
You're overcome with emotion right now, remembering that.
And it went up. And it was upside down the first time. Came down, and then it went up, and we all cheered.
Wow. Yeah. I can't imagine what that felt like after everything you've been through from the time that you got out of that airplane until then. I mean, that just had to be the most glorious thing you ever saw.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry.
I think everyone understands the emotions that must be going through your heart right now.
Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we were, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor. On the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go. I'm going to say, the sign said, "Welcome home. Well done."
Of the 130,000 Americans who were prisoners of war during World War II, 116,000, like Ray, got to hear those words, "Welcome home," but there were also 14,000 who died in captivity. We honor all of them today, as well as those still missing. We're overdue for our first break, but when we come back, a man who spent nearly 4 years as a prisoner and is now 102 years old. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.